Maget flourished a forearm plate attachment, tapped it, and the canopy popped. It parted into two top-hinged hatches, and he swung himself into the cockpit. Also hinges from the lower edge, in case the pilot has to bang out. Now, the avionics. Synthetic vision, panoramic cockpit display, eye-controlled switch selection, aiming the works.
Sounds like you had a contest to see how many gizmos you could cram into one fighter.
All we've been able to do since the Vong War ended is re-establish our basic production models and work up some better ideas. Yamaget leaned over the side of the fighter. They all ended up in here.
So?
Well, you wanted to know what we might manufacture with the new Beskar. Personally, I'd be inclined to incorporate it into the airframe. Micronized Beskar skin, or laminate Beskar armor.
That would make it the fastest, least vulnerable fighter on the market. The weapons load might be a compromise.
Fett wasn't sure if he had the power or right to tell Mandal Motors what to do with their product. This wasn't Coruscant, where national security overrode commercial concerns by law.
Add the top-end armaments, though, and I wouldn't want that sold to anyone else.
Don't worry. We'll de-enrich the spec for export. We live here, remember? We all lost family to the Vong. Yamaget jumped down from the cockpit with an agility Fett envied. Then he pressed the forearm plate attachment, and the fighter made a faint grinding sound before tilting back on its tail section and lifting through a full 90 degrees to sit upright, a mechanism not dissimilar to Slave One's. It can land vertically in a footprint of a little over 32 square meters. Fett walked a few meters away to get a better idea of the shape. It didn't look like any other vessel he'd seen.
I bet it does tricks, too.
Our shares have rocketed, and we haven't even unveiled this.
I bought a few. Someone had to make sure the majority shareholding stayed in Mandalorian hands.
Just as well we don't have a law against insider dealing.
I don't intend to sell. Might sign them over to someone, on the condition they never sell on to Arutise.
Is that a go-ahead for production?
Full spec for us, de-enriched for them.
Fett walked away briskly, feeling his unconnected acts of prudence falling together in a policy of sorts.
Make sure the export hyperdrive spec is a fraction better than an X-Wing. No more.
Yamaget trailed after him. We're going to arm the Confederacy then, said Yamaget.
We'll arm anybody, including the GA, if they can pay.
Fett hadn't even thought about the next move. It just happened.
Provided Colonel Jason Solo comes here in person to negotiate the deal.
You're a subtle man, Fett.
I've never been called that before.
50% of production for our own defense?
Defense. That was one word for it.
Agreed.
Mandalorians liked a sensible compromise. The best deals were where both sides were happy. Or where one was happy and the other dead.
It'll be called the Basilisk, Yamaget called after him. The Basilisk. I always had a soft spot for the ancient battle droids.
Chabi Spaceport, Vulptor, Deep Core.
Ben pressed as close to the viewport as he could to peer at the permacrete below. It was hazy daylight outside. But his body said it was still last night, and he needed more sleep. As far as the rest of the spaceport was concerned, the well-maintained but very old Income Tourer was not a Galactic Alliance guard ship carefully contaminated with Corellian dust, Corellian food waste, Corellian fabric, and any number of other touches designed to show a forensics team that the vessel definitely came from Corellia. And the battered intersystem delivery cutter tailing Cal Omas's shuttle wasn't a spy vessel with top-of-the-line comms, spoofing devices, and an overpowered hyperdrive. Jory Lakoff wasn't a GAG assassin, either. He was just a nice, ordinary young Corellian, on an adventure with his younger cousin, in an elderly ship he'd saved every spare credit for a couple of years to buy. The trouble was that Ben could believe that all too easily, even though he'd seen the range of weapons Lakoff carried under his jacket. It was a long wait. Shivu would make contact with them when he landed. His last transmission said he was a few minutes behind Omas's shuttle, which wouldn't attract suspicion. They said Vulptr had once been a lovely planet. It didn't look lovely now. The skies had that polluted, smoky haze that meant there were wonderful red sunsets here and not much else to be grateful for. And this was after they tried to clean up the environment. The vast landing strip, landing field, more like, was scattered with dozens upon dozens of craft in varying stages of disrepair, some taking on board supplies and fuel, some berthing next to freight warehouses where conveyor belts disgorge crates into their holds. Their outlines shimmered in the heat haze from idling drives. And there were all kinds of species wandering around on foot between the vessels, stretching their legs. Anywhere between one pair and four of them, it seemed.
"Stand by," Lakoff said quietly, pressing his fingertip to his ear. "It's the captain."
"Yes, sir.
Copy that."
He looked up.
"About 12 minutes before Omos lands. Shiva's right behind him in the landing queue."
Ben perked up. The Karpaki was folded in two inside his jacket, right on the limit of what he could hide, and the vibroblade was tucked in his hip pocket. Ben fidgeted with the vibroblade, wondering how his mother would have tackled a job like this. Ben switched seats in the cramped interior to look out from the starboard side. Gedgen's ship should have landed by now, according to its flight plan. One pilot, 3 passengers, maximum 5-hour stopover. That was what it said on the CPA information database that his datapad, scrubbed of all identity in case of capture, showed him. Ben concentrated on centering himself, edging a little toward that state where he vanished from the Force. He pulled himself back just as he felt a drifting sensation that could have been disappearance, or nodding off.
"Plug yourself in," Lakoff whispered. "It's a go."
Ben activated his comlink and earpiece and shut down the environmental controls to leave the Tourer. When Lakoff opened the hatch, the air and noise hit Ben like a solid wall. It smelled of factories and sulfur. They ambled down the ramp, working hard at looking ordinary, and made their way toward the terminal buildings as if they were killing time, not politicians. Lakoff scratched his ear, repositioning the earpiece.
"Got you, sir. Position?"
Ben picked up Shivu's voice clearly.
"He'll pass 30 meters to the left of you, unless he deviates. Heading for Building G. You pick him up, and I'll follow you in."
"No visual on the target yet."
They couldn't afford to be spotted. Ben slouched and meandered as 14-year-old boys were prone to do, turning around from time to time to chat to Lakoff about safe and meaningless trivia. Baker Rock, speeders, anything, while he took a cautious look across the permacrete in Omos's direction. And there he was, flanked by 2 men in working clothes, a carefully scruffy figure himself.
"Going okay?"
Lakoff whispered, not looking toward the 3 men. One of the GA intelligence agents walked through the doors of Building G in front of Omos. The other followed close enough to tread on his heels. They almost vanished in the crowds inside the terminal building, but Ben kept them in sight even though he lost Lakoff for a few moments. One of them appeared to be checking the numbers on various doors and exits as he walked, and eventually he stopped at one marked 53L and inserted a credit chip in the slot to one side. The doors parted, and Ben got a glimpse of a small, brightly lit room almost filled by a white Duraplast table ringed by chairs. There was already someone in there. The doors closed again.
"You can do this,"
Lakoff said.
"How many in there? I can't place the strip cam under the doors if someone else is going to come along and open them again."
Ben closed his eyes and concentrated on the ebb and flow of the Force, the patterns of density that he could both feel at the roof of his mouth and see as speckled color behind his eyelids.
6, he said. "They're all inside now."
"Can you see lottery numbers, too?"
Lakoff made his way casually through the shoals of people and squatted down to adjust his boot. Ben saw him take out what looked like a small, flimsy strip, then slide the thing under the hairline gap with quick ease. Strip cams were very small these days, the size of a coat check stub. They really were flimsy, and just as disposable once they'd finished transmitting.
"Lovely,"
said Shivu's voice in Ben's ear.
"I can see right up Gedgen's nose. Good clear sound. Nice job, Jory."
Eventually, Ben glanced around and spotted Shivu leaning against a drinks dispenser on the other side of the concourse. He was recording the output from the strip cam and transmitting it back to GAG headquarters. As soon as he had confirmation that it had been received and stored, he'd erase his datapad and send a code to the strip cam to shred its data. It'd be just a scrap of garbage the cleaners would sweep up, if they ever came this way. It looked as if they didn't. Ben and Lakoff could hear the conversation in their earpieces, both of them monitoring it so they knew when to vanish, wait for Gedgen to emerge, and follow him. It was a fascinating conversation. He recognized Omas's voice. Gedgen sounded softer than he did on the HNE bulletins. Ben was hearing the last words Der Gedgen would ever speak.
So, we can agree as gentle beings to cease hostilities while we sort out a compromise?
Before or after I take this to the Senate?
Omas asked.
I'm not referring this to my assembly, yet. You might not need to refer it to yours,
Gedgen replied.
We'll stand down if you agree to that form of revised wording in the commitment of planetary defense assets to the GA.
You might be able to deliver that with Corellian forces, but can you pull back the Bothans?
Are you sure Nyathol will do as you tell her?
She's a career officer. She will. As a show of goodwill, you'll commit forces to helping us restore order in places like the CPAN system.
Of course. And you need us to come back into the GA fold to stop the membership hemorrhaging away.
I won't ask for any statement that causes loss of face. I know how proud Corellians are. Just something along the lines of differences being bridgeable.
That's very gracious, Chief Omas. Now, those differences will only be bridged if Admiral Nyathol and Colonel Solo no longer carry the military weight they do now.
You want me to fire them?
I think you might need to do more than fire them, now that they're used to getting their own way.
I think I know what you mean, and I don't care for that solution.
Nyathol, ambitious, dangerous. Solo, ambitious, dangerous, and Jedi, too. We can solve the problem for you, permanently.
If you do, I don't need to know about it.
Ben began to visualize the exterior of the terminal buildings. A walkway ran along the roof, a little-used observation deck where anyone could sit and watch vessels taking off and landing. It wasn't a popular spot, but it was perfect for a sniper. As soon as the meeting sounded as if it was coming to an end, Ben had a minute or two to get up on that roof and wait for Gedgen to exit. There were three sets of doors Gedgen could leave through to walk back onto the landing field and rejoin his ship. To cover that span, a couple of 100 meters, Ben would have to be ready to sprint along that platform in either direction from a central point.
I'm ready.
He pressed his arm against his side and felt the Carpaki. It would be almost completely silent. He'd also be standing on top of a stark permacrete platform with no cover.
I'll just have to be fast then.
The conversation between Omas and Gedgen slowed, and there were longer pauses and more restless grunts and sighs. Business was drawing to a close. At a nudge from Lakoff, Ben began walking to the roof turbolift without even looking back. He stood in the turbolift cab with a family of Triani looking for a tap calf, wondering if they could smell his intentions. Ben stepped back into the shadow of a single lonely air conditioning outflow and unfolded the Carpaki. If he held it against the leg of his baggy, creased pants, it didn't present such an obvious profile. He settled down to wait for Shivu and Lakoff to do the spotting for him.
Jason's going to go crazy when he hears what Omas has in mind for him.
Ben, heads up!
It was Shivu.
Gedgen's on the move. He's exiting via the south doors. Go right!
Ben checked around him and jogged to the far end of the platform, keeping close to the rear wall. He hoped he'd recognize Gedgen. He studied the man's face and walk intently before the mission, but now he might be looking at the back of his head, depending on the exact path he took back to the ship. But when he looked down on the permacrete and the chaos of ships, freight droids, and species of all kinds wandering around as if it were a theme park, that neat military haircut, jet black, glossy, not a strand out of place, drew his eye like a beacon. He lay prone and sighted up. The optics brought him instantly 100 meters closer to Dergedjan. And then there was no doubt that he had the right man in his crosswires. As Gedjan walked, two security guards in discreet casual clothes weaved in and out of Ben's shot. As soon as Gedjan dropped, at least one of them would be looking for where the shot had originated. Ben would have to stay low and melt back into the crowds in the airside terminal, then rendezvous with Lakoff at Shivu's transport.
I can do it. I got in and out of center point, didn't I?
Ben held his breath, let the Carpaki's smart optics adjust for wind and angle, and felt his finger tighten on the trigger. 1 second, Gedjan's neat dark head was filling the scope, and the next, Ben was staring at empty permacrete as the rifle kicked back against his shoulder. The muffled report seemed to come from a long way away. Nothing seemed to have gone down in the order he expected. Shot, recoil, drop. He lay flat.
What happened? Did I kill him?
He could hear shouts carried on the air from 3 stories below. His body made the decisions for him, and he found himself scrambling backward to the rear wall, while Shivu's voice in his ear kept saying,
Get out of there, Ben!
Speeder Park, Rotunda Zone, Coruscant.
Lumaya had left a magnified wake in the Force, like a water speeder on a lake. While it was generous of her, Mara wasn't amused. I didn't get stupid overnight, she muttered. Don't insult me, Tin Can.
And what were you saying about Luke being too close to all this?
Jaina asked.
Deep breaths, Aunt Mara. Deep breaths.
I'm psyching up. I find it helps.
You use the Force your way and I'll use it mine. Wow, am I calming you down now? That's a headline to save for the grandchildren.
Mara paced a 10-meter square of the area, feeling dark energies pulsing like shockwaves. Jaina stood back and watched.
She's taken off from here, Mara stated. Has she led us here to divert us from somewhere else on Coruscant?
She's got a narrow range of targets, Jaina. Ben or Jason, or even Han and Leia if she's teamed up with Alima.
Your parents aren't on Coruscant, and if she's after Jason, she must have had her chance to take him when she got into GAG headquarters to grab Ben's boots. So it's Ben.
Ben's away. He's not on Coruscant. GAG business, Mara said, answering the unasked question. She cast around in the Force, groping for anything that said Lumaya was heading for Volptr. But she had no sense of that at all.
Okay. If she wants me to follow her, I'll follow.
Let's call in Zek and Jag, because I'm betting Alima's in town again, and
no offense, Jaina, but I think it's me she wants. You go find Bug Girl.
Mara returned to base to find one of the ground crew waiting patiently by her allocated XJ-7. She climbed into the cockpit and started her instrument check. Mara ignored military air traffic regulations and circled over the area where she'd last picked up Lumaya's powerful wake. If she concentrated, it was relatively easy to follow, and she found herself leaving Coruscant orbit on a bearing for one of the moons, Hesperidium. The wake led to Hesperidium's main resort, which wasn't quite as splendid as Mara recalled. Port traffic control was surprised, to say the least, to find a military vessel on its scanners.
I need to put down for a while, Mara said, knowing they had no choice about the matter. Getting weird readings on my instruments. I have to check it out.
When she landed and saw the selection of vessels standing on the private strips of the hotels, she realized that an XJ-7 probably looked like an eccentric billionaire's toy, and a small one at that. She checked around her, in the Force and visually, before sliding out of the cockpit and jumping to the ground. It was early. A couple of hotel guests in sports clothes jogged by and glanced at her, but ran on. She prowled between the vessels on the strip, feeling the darkness pressing on her sternum like a coronary. Something dark was here, and that meant Lumaya. The crushing sensation in her chest was getting so powerful that she ignited her lightsaber's blade, ready to fight when she rounded the next hull.
This is it, Lumaya. No more games.
She sprang into the gap, lightsaber humming. Staring back at her wasn't a veiled figure with a light whip, but
but a single disembodied flame-red eye, 10 meters wide. Her instinct said it was alive, an alien being, but it was clearly a ship of some kind. And that meant only one thing. Lumaya was inside. It was a trap. Mara was sure of that. Fine. But sometimes traps swallow prey that's way too big for them. She looked over the hull for a hatch, but the roughly textured surface, was it stone? Was unbroken.
Come inside.
Mara wondered why she was thinking that, and then realized that the thought was actually a voice inside her head, in the fabric of the Force itself. It was inanimate, yet sentient, and it wasn't a droid. It was the ship. Suddenly, an aperture appeared in the hull, and a ramp extruded. It was too tempting, and she was too old a hand at this kind of game to walk straight in. But she had to know what was going on. She placed her boot on the ramp and took a few cautious steps, lightsaber held two-handed. Mara hesitated on the brow of the ramp. She thought for a minute that she might be pulled in, and the spherical ship would then trap her inside and make a run for it. Mara took a cautious breath and lowered her head to look inside. The ship really was empty. Not just devoid of crew. Empty. And that was as far as she got. She felt something coming, and she knew what that something was. She took a few steps back down the ramp and waited, lightsaber still extended. A slim figure in a dark gray suit and veiled triangular headdress stepped into the space between the parked ships.
"Hello, little housewife," said Lumaya.
Mara's autopilot kicked in, and she was the Emperor's hand again. Silent and focused, there was nothing worth saying anyway. Amateurs gave speeches. Professionals got on with the job. She force-leapt 5 meters at Lumaya, slashing down right to left, two-handed. The stroke, all power, no finesse, clipped the Sith's headdress as she sprang back, slicing off a section. Lumaya's eyes widened, pupils dilated, but she was already whirling her light whip about her head. Mara drew her blaster and rolled under the hull of the ship next to her. The light whip gouged through the durasteel with a shriek of tearing metal, filling the air with the smell of hydraulic fluid, and the spurt of liquid turned into a torrent that began spreading in a thick pool. As Mara rolled clear on the other side of the ship, Lumaya landed heavily on both feet and brought the whip down so close to Mara's head that she felt the rush of air on her right cheek, like a breath. The crack was deafening. Mara wasn't even thinking when she aimed the blaster. Lumaya's whip hand was raised to throw as much weight as possible from the backstroke. A puff of white vapor burst from Lumaya's shoulder, and she staggered a few paces. Metal. Maybe I hit metal. Maybe she had, because Lumaya teetered for a second but came right back. Mara sprang horizontally from a crouch and cannoned into Lumaya's legs with all the power she could muster from the Force. She hit solid durasteel. Blood filled her mouth, but she couldn't feel a thing yet. Clinging to Lumaya's knees with one arm, denying her the space to swing the whip, she brought her down like a felled tree before smashing her head into the woman's face. And that hurt. Oh yes, Mara felt that. She caught not Lumaya's nose, but the cybernetic jaw, and it cut deep into her forehead. Fighting on pure reflex now, part stunned, she killed the lightsaber blade for a second and held the hilt like a dagger, stabbing it down into Lumaya's chest before flicking the energy back on. Lumaya pulled to the side as the blade punched through flesh. Mara smelled it. She flicked off the blade to pull back again, triumphant. "I've done it. Dead. Dead, you..." But Lumaya was screaming, and that wasn't right at all. The scream seared through Mara's spinning head. It was more than sound. It was... Mara scrambled to her knees to look down at what should have been a dead woman, and stared into green eyes that were utterly devoid of any emotion. And then, the world darkened like an eclipse. "Maybe I'm the one who's dead." Something hit her square in the back, pitching her forward onto Lumaya. Mara struggled to turn over without letting go of either lightsaber or blaster, but something coiled around her neck and jerked her backward. The light whip was still in Lumaya's fist. She could see the thing. She could see it. So what was around her neck, choking her? She felt as if she was flying backward at high speed, and then she hit something so hard that it punched every bit of breath out of her lungs and left her gulping for air. A second or two was all it took. Mara lay trying to suck in air in painful, straining gulps, eyes stinging, and saw Lumaya's boots run past her face at a stagger, missing her by centimeters. "What's in my eyes? What's stinging?" She raised her hand to rub them, and her knuckles came away red and wet. It was blood. The last thing she saw as she looked up was the orange sphere, that impossible Sith ship soaring vertically into the air and extending webbed veins like living wings. Mara managed to prop herself up on her elbows. "I was sure I finished her off. How did I miss?" She almost sobbed with frustration and struggled to get into the XJ-7's cockpit, still trying to work out what had jumped her from behind. When she checked her injuries in the reflective surface on her datapad, her face was streaked with blood. Her right eye was swelling and closing already, and there was something like a rope burn across her neck. She could see indentations in her skin that looked like a twisted wire cable. "Something like a droid jumped me. A machine, anyway. That's why I didn't sense it." It was crazy to fly a fighter after a head injury, she knew. But there was no other way back to Coruscant. Her adrenaline was ebbing, and the pain was making itself felt now. She settled into a shallow, meditative trance to speed the healing process. Why didn't she kill me? She had the chance. I brained myself on her criffing metal jaw. Then Mara remembered the transponder. She fumbled for the datapad again and activated the search emitter. A yellow blip. No, two yellow blips showed. One was still on Volptor, Ben. The other was edging across the grid on her screen, moving away from the core. Lumaya. Gotcha, she thought. Lumaya and her bizarre Sith ship were on a bearing for the Hydean Way node. Either she wanted Mara to follow, or she didn't know about the transponder. It was okay. Mara could take her any time now, and two could play the come-and-get-me game.
Jason Solo's office, doors closed, GAG headquarters, Coruscant.
Jason played the recording four or five times before he was satisfied. It was a distorted ground-up shot, the sort that endoscopic strip cams tended to capture. But the soundtrack was clear, and the participants in the meeting were clearly identifiable as the GA Chief of State and the Corellian Prime Minister. There would be no argument that the two men had met, thrown out the GA's entire defense policy, agreed on private terms for a ceasefire without reference to the Supreme Commander or the Senate, and discussed the removal by assassination of Colonel Jason Solo and Admiral Niathal. This was all he needed to justify the next step. "I've got you now, Cal Omas. I've got you, you fool." At midnight, after activating an amendment he slipped into some legislation a few days ago, he would have the legal authority to arrest Chief of State Cal Omas for actions likely to present a risk to the security of the Galactic Alliance. He would notify the Supreme Commander, who was, until 0900 tomorrow, the acting Chief of State in Omas's absence, and who would step into his place if for any reason he couldn't discharge his duties.
Charby Spaceport, Volptor.
It was a lockdown. Ben, like everyone else in the crowd, stood still as a Corellian security officer, Ministerial Protection Branch, he guessed, trained his blaster on the crowd.
"Nobody's going anywhere," he said. "This port is being sealed by the Volptor authorities, and you're all going to be scanned for ballistic residue." "Why?" a male voice called from the crowd.
"There's been a projectile shooting," the officer said, "and I want you all to wait nice and calm, and then we'll check you all out and you'll be free to go."
The hum of murmurs, gasps, clicks, and other varied expressions of horror and impatience swept across the gathering crowd. Ben's gut was knotted tight. He didn't dare look behind him to see where Shivu and Lakoff were. He could feel their presence and had a good idea of their positions, but that wasn't enough. He needed to see them. Carefully, he turned around and caught Lakoff's eye. He ambled over to him, slowing down as he passed so it wasn't obvious they were together. Ben felt everyone could see the rifle folded under his jacket, even though they all seemed far more interested in what was happening beyond the transparisteel doors to the landing area. Red and blue lights were reflecting off the walls as security vehicles streamed onto the field. Lakoff was right next to Ben now. In the crush of passengers and pilots milling around, getting in one another's way, he could press right up against him unnoticed. The lieutenant reached under Ben's coat and grasped the rifle. Ben clamped his arm tight against his side to stop him from taking it.
What are you doing?
Contingency plan. Let go, Ben.
You're gonna dump it?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm gonna get rid of it. Lakoff stood chest to chest with Ben, and after a 2-second, almost immobile tussle that nobody else could see, he loosened Ben's clamped elbow and slid the folded carpaki under his own jacket. Now stick with the boss. Promise me you will.
You're nuts, Jory.
Yeah, like Granddad. Lakoff moved back along the terminal hall to the central doors that led onto the landing area. Ben went to follow him, but Shibu stepped into his path casually, as if being rude and careless to a stranger.
Whatever happens, he said, almost inaudible, lips barely moving, you're to stick with me and follow me unless I get grabbed. In that case, get back to the base any way you can.
Lakoff was at the main doors, looking as if he were trying to check where the tourer was. Then, without warning, he grabbed a woman tight around her neck, drew his blaster, and held it to her temple.
Open the doors, he yelled. Open them now or I'll blow her head off.
Pandemonium broke out. People scattered, leaving a clear area around Lakoff. Security officers and a Corellian cop struggled against the tide of bodies trying to get clear, blasters held high. Lakoff was suddenly doing an amazing job of looking red-faced and dangerous.
I said open the criffing doors, or you'll be scraping her off the ceiling!
Lakoff clicked the blaster, and the woman hostage started shrieking, a thin little wail at first that rose into a full-blown panting sequence of screams and yelps.
You're going to let me board my ship and leave here, and she gets to live. Don't mess with me. Don't criffing mess with me.
Just let the lady go, said the officer. Just put the blaster down, let her go.
So you can spray my brains all over the terminal? Yeah, as if.
Kid, this isn't gonna do you any good. We can talk.
Yeah, like you'll have a nice chat with me about Gedgen. I killed the scumbag, and I'm proud of it. He was caving into the GA, lining his own pockets. I'm a patriot, you hear? I love Corellia. They ought to give me a medal.
The officer gestured to the security guard at the exit, and the doors parted. Ben watched in horror, unable to move. Lakoff backed out of the doors, half dragging and half carrying the terrified hostage, and made his way laboriously to the tourer. It seemed to take forever. It was a long, long way to struggle with a woman in a headlock, edging backward, followed by a slowly moving knot of police and guards waiting for the first slip that would give them a clear shot at him. Lakoff activated the tourer's ramp and backed up it. The woman had stopped screaming and started sobbing.
Okay, out now.
Shibu was right behind Ben, mouth right next to his ear, and he grabbed his collar in a slow, twisting grip to show he meant business.
Slow and calm. Don't waste this. He's bought us time.
Ben wanted to yell, but what about him? He didn't, though. He'd already abandoned too much of his training, and this wasn't the way soldiers did it. His legs were shaking under him. Lakoff reached the top of the ramp and shoved the woman down it. The hatch slammed behind him, leaving the hostage crying and screaming on the permacrete. Police rushed forward to grab her. Marksmen moved in to take up positions around the vessel. Now everyone else in the terminal was forgotten, and the Corellian officer ran onto the field, met up with his buddy, and ran for the cordon.
Ben, that's it. Come on.
Shibu jerked on his collar, pulling him bodily toward the doors at the south end of the terminal. A little bit of Ben was calculating where they would be placing troops and what their tactics would be for stopping Lakoff from taking off. If Lakoff got a move on, he could be out of orbit and jumping to light speed before whatever excuse Vulture had for a fleet could get airborne. But the tourer sat on the permacrete, silent. No haze of heat exhaust venting from its jets. He could see it through the transparisteel walls as he moved toward escape, and couldn't feel relief. It dawned on Ben that Lakoff wasn't going anywhere. Maybe the thing had failed to start.
Oh, no.
The drive hadn't stalled on him. Ben could feel Lakoff now, terrified, oddly triumphant, and with a strange sense of peace despite the dread. It was the strangest combination Ben had ever sensed in the Force.
What's he doing, sir? How's he getting out?
Shivu kept swallowing. Ben saw the lump in his throat bob up and down. Has to be done.
What has to be done?
A good cover story.
Slave One laid up outside Keldabe, Mandalore.
It was a very interesting news day. Fett had his cockpit monitor tuned to the news channel, watching the wheels come off the rest of the galaxy. He'd seen that happen often enough to spot the signs of a greater chaos to come. Usually it meant a time of good fees and rich pickings for bounty hunters. Now his priorities had to be a little different, and he waited for a call from the office of Sass Sikili, the Verpine, whose job was to communicate with outsiders on behalf of Roche. The Verpine were getting anxious. How any species that churned out that many high-quality ornaments could get anxious, Fett didn't understand. But that was the Verpine for you. Insectoids could get jumpy. And when one got jumpy, the hive mind made them all jittery. Fett pondered the assassination while he waited. He couldn't say he was sorry to see the passing of Dirk Edgen, but at least the Barv paid promptly. Fett had been betting on him staying in office for more than a few short months before getting the inevitable shot in the head, though. It was indecently premature, even by the standards of Corellian politics. Who had really killed him? Not some Corellian hick waving the flag, that was for sure. Gedgen had a line of would-be killers that would have stretched from here to the core.
"Mandalore Fett," said a voice on the comlink.
It was high-pitched, a little above tenor, and buzzed with a faint resonance.
"We noted your return with delight."
"Need someone dragged screaming to your hive, Sikili?"
"Not today, thank you. But we have a business proposition for you."
"I'm all ears."
We hear exciting things about iron deposits, which we assume to be true."
"They are."
"And many highly desirable things can be made with Mandalorian iron. We would like to acquire some."
"Happy to sell, when we have a surplus for export."
"We note the unstable nature of the galaxy these past months, which will be exacerbated, we expect, by the passing of Prime Minister Gedgen."
"Yeah, good times for the arms trade."
"Indeed. But also anxious times for us, when Mercana challenges our markets, and now Keemstore Eye talks of war with Mercana, which is too close for the Hive's taste."
"You pack enough hardware to make Mercana and Keemstore Eye into their own asteroid field, Sikili. If the kid comes from Roche, spit it out."
"We are literal people, Fett."
"I'm literal too. Let's all be literal together."
Sikili went quiet for a moment. Fett could hear the faint clicking of his mouthparts.
"Now that you have abundant Beskar, you'll rearm. Roche is on the borders of your sector. Last time Mandalorians had plenty of Beskar, the Mandalore sector became much, much bigger."
Verpine took a little time to explain where they were heading, grinding through each step of the sequence. But they got there in the end.
"You're worried we'll expand all over you," said Fett. "Invade you."
"Yes, it's the specialty of your species."
"We're homebodies now. We like to put our feet up and watch the holovids."
"When you make jokes, the hives become more worried, because you're not a joking man, therefore..."
It was getting painful, and he didn't want to hear Sikili's character analysis. Fett found it amusing that he hadn't threatened or hinted about the fate of Roche, or even thought much about it. But that had always been part of his armory, as it had been for Mandalorians as a whole. They had a certain reputation that did the advance work for them.
"Sign a treaty with us, then."
"To do what, Fett?"
"Non-aggression pact. neighborly mutual aid.
You have nothing to fear from us, so you'll want something in exchange, because you're a mercenary and...
Bounty hunter, part-time. What I want is the mutual bit.
What can we do for you to avoid being added to your collection?
Supply us with exclusive products in exchange for our exclusive metal. We give you our special skills, military strength, and you give us yours in defense technology and quality control. Maybe even joint work on new projects.
Ah, you Mandalorians have always adopted technology from others. You might forcibly adopt ours now.
Deal's on the table. You made me notice you. Bad idea.
Sakili was silent again. Verpines had a way of communicating instantly with all Hive members through some organ in their chests. Fett guessed that Sakili was consulting the Hive.
Deal accepted. We'll need details.
I'll get my people to talk to your people.
Fett could imagine the reaction on Coruscant and Corellia.
We look forward to a long and productive alliance with Roche.
We will announce this happy and reassuring news. Good day, Fett.
Fett noticed a message was waiting for him. It could have been relayed straight to his HUD, but Jang Skirata did things his own idiosyncratic way.
I see you did right by Mandalore. I'll do right by you.
Fett hadn't judged wrong then. He dropped his dose of capsules into his palm and washed them down with a mix of water and the cocktail of liquid drugs that Belluene had prescribed. It was just slowing down his decline, not stopping it. Jang hadn't said he'd succeeded.
Death's a motivator, not a threat. You've still got things to achieve before you become fertilizer. You'll just have to do them sooner rather than later.
Fett switched on the monitor in his cramped quarters and sat back with a pack of dry rations to watch the news as Corellia went into meltdown and the Verpine government of Roche announced talks with Mandalore to agree to a mutual aid and trade treaty. He decided tomorrow might be a very good day to go public on the Besulik.
Jedi Council Chamber, Coruscant, emergency meeting.
This one,
said Master Saba Sabatine,
would like to be assured that the Alliance had nothing to do with Gedgen's death. It was unnecessary.
Luke couldn't blame her for jumping to conclusions. It was his first thought, too. And his second thought was that the GA agents, or even Jason, had a hand in it. But the assassin had, it seemed, sealed himself in his ship and blown it up. A Corellian-registered ship scattering solidly Corellian evidence. Luke had seen crazier things than that. It was a zealot's act, and all too common. There are plenty of Corellians with reasons to want Gedgen dead, he said. Where had Mara got to? He half expected her to stride through the doors of the chamber carrying Lumaya's head in triumph. But I'll conduct my own investigations. Corrin Horn looked up from his clasped hands, which he'd been studying with unnatural concentration. It couldn't have been easy watching his homeworld plunge into recrimination and finger-pointing.
It's less about who actually did it than who the various factions think did it, and that won't be influenced by anything as irrelevant as hard facts.
Well, I need to know, and I don't want HNE telling me, Luke said. Kip, can you monitor the headlines while we're meeting?
Time was, said Kip Duren, when the government of the day used to keep the Jedi Council informed, and we didn't have to rely on the media.
Yes, Luke had noticed that the Council was no longer kept in the loop. He returned to the main issue.
So what if it is us?
So far, everyone had managed to avoid mentioning Jason. Kyle Katarn joined in.
Is assassinating heads of state legal?
In a war, I believe it is.
Just to spice up the mix, the Mandalorians are joining forces with the Verpine.
Kip seemed to be listening to the news via an earpiece, judging by the glazed and defocused look in his eyes.
What does that sound like to you?
Luke thought of Fett's dead daughter, Jason's guilt, and Fett's track record.
They're rearming, Luke said,
They said they were staying neutral. Kyle shook his head slowly, brushing specks from his lap in a distracted way. Oh, yeah. If my long-lost daughter was tortured to death by the GA's secret police, I'd be neutral. First thing I'd do. Walk away and be very, very neutral.
You don't have to be on one of two sides to rearm, or even take part in a war, Luke said. Still, nobody said the J word, but Luke could hear the name at the back of every mind.
Well, we know a few facts, Kyle counted off on his fingers. One, Mandalorians aren't exactly heavily represented in social services and the caring professions. Two, they have a brand new supply of that iron of theirs for their war machine. Three, allying with the Verpine makes them the single most powerful producer of advanced weapons technology. Four, I hear they're still sore about getting no help to rebuild post-war when they went out on a limb for the New Republic.
It's not good, is it? Said Corrin.
I'm betting they'll step up for Corellia in the next few days.
Fett's said to have killed Sal Solo, or at least one of his Mondo thugs did. Where does that leave them?
Luke had heard the real story from Han. I think we should offer Jedi meditation to both the GA and Corellia as far as the assassination goes, he said. I know it sounds bizarre in the middle of a war, but there's war with rules and there's war with no holds barred, and we need to... The doors opened, and Mara walked in.
Sorry I'm late, she said. Ran into a few problems.
She managed to stop the meeting dead. Luke stared in horror at her face. She had a black eye and a split lip. She was holding herself as if her ribs hurt. She settled into her seat in the circle with slow care.
Ran into an armored division, more like, said Kip, staring. What happened to you? And where shall we send the flowers for the other guy? And this is after a healing trance.
She smiled, and it was genuine, but there was definite anxiety.
Sorry to interrupt, she went on. I assume we're worrying about the implications of Gedgen's death? And Mandalorian rearmament?
Forget that for just a second, Luke said. Mara, I need to know what happened to you.
Why, darling, thank you for asking. I'm very well, just a flesh wound.
She shook her head in disbelief, but it seemed aimed at herself.
Look, I caught Lumaya. She's in a worse state than I am, believe me.
And?
The situation's under control.
Where is she?
I'm tracking her to her base.
All 11 council members were waiting in complete silence for Mara's next words.
It's no good looking at me like that, she said. I'm not discussing it. I'm not sharing the mission, and I'm not going to take it easy, which I'll bet is going to be someone's suggestion. Yes?
Mara hath spoken, said Kip.
But that doesn't stop me asking where Lumaya is and what she's driving.
Nice try. But go find your own deranged Darksider to play with, because Lumaya's mine.
Corrin gave Luke a knowing smile. She's fine. Luke moved the meeting on.
Can we actually do anything about the Gedgen situation here and now?
There was a chorus of reluctant no around the circle. Okay, then. All we can do is keep an eye on the situation, and I've got a request in with Omos to see him as soon as he gets back.
You know what happens when heads of state are away when a crisis breaks, Kip pointed out.
They take a pounding in the polls, and it's the beginning of the end. Let's make the most of Omos while we can. Who's friendly with Nyathol?
They all turned to look pointedly at Silgal. She tilted her head slightly to fix Luke with one eye, always a disconcerting thing in a Mon Calamari.
Just because we're Mon Cals, Luke, it doesn't mean we have guaranteed harmony. We come from different schools of thought.
You're Akbar's niece, and I bet that counts for a lot with a Mon Cal admiral.
I'll do my best, then.
The meeting broke up, Mara remaining seated. Luke waited until everyone was well out of earshot, and then walked over to squat in front of Mara and put his hands on her knees.
You can't keep this from me. I headbutted her, that's all. Metal jaw, non-metal head. If you got that close, how did she get away?
Oh, bad question. Luke braced for an onslaught about shaking hands again.
I think she has a droid with her. Something jumped me from behind, and it wasn't organic. Mara showed him a discolored mark, like a rope burn, at the front of her neck. Whatever it is, it can pay out a metal cable. And she has this weird spherical ship, like a disembodied orange eye. Don't you think that's all a good case for not hunting her alone? She wants me to catch up with her. I'll be extra ready next time. And there will be a next time.
Coruscant Military Spaceport.
Ben sat in the cargo hold of the ship long after the ground crew had secured the landing dampers and the drives had cooled completely. He was almost comfortable, staring at the bulkhead opposite, in the sense that he had feared taking his eyes off it. If he did that, the numbing meditation he'd slipped into would be broken, and he would have to think. Jory Lakoff was gone. It was one of those facts he couldn't take in even when he saw it happen. The guy had been alive and well the night before, even hours ago. And now he didn't exist. Ben simply couldn't feel death.
Come on, Ben. The techs want to start stripping down this crate.
Captain Shivu stood in the hatch, fingers hooked over the top edge of the combing. Ben felt that if he moved, the whole world would come unraveled.
I'll be along in a minute.
Shivu waited for a moment, and then came to sit down with him.
We don't lose many troopers in Special Forces. It makes it harder when we do. I think. It's hard for me anyway.
Ben gambled on whether to speak or not. He took a breath and waited to feel everything around him shatter.
He didn't have to die, sir.
Once he heard his own voice, Ben just felt like he couldn't breathe. Nothing worse.
He could have taken off. We could have run for it or even been captured, and the job would still have been done.
Ben, our orders were to make it look like a Corellian schism, and not to get caught or leave a trail. Can't have a Jedi exposed as assassins, especially not you. We had to get you out of there.
It didn't have to be me. Any trooper could have done the job. I wanted to do my duty, but if it hadn't been me, if Jory hadn't felt he had to protect my identity, he'd be alive.
Ben, what do you think would have happened to him if he'd been taken back to Corellia?
Shivu lowered his voice.
You saw what we do here to prisoners. You think worse than that can't happen in Coronet?
So what if I had been caught? My dad would have been humiliated? So what? Jory's life for dad being upset?
I could give you a list of reasons why having Corellia think their own kind did it helps the GA. But you don't want to hear that right now.
Shivu stood up and beckoned to Ben to follow. He meant it.
There are anti-Gedgen factions claiming responsibility, so the mission worked fine, strategically. Now go home, and take a couple of days off.
Shivu stopped a passing ground crew speeder, and told the driver to get Ben back to HQ.
Wash that stuff out of your hair, and go home.
An hour later, Ben found himself staring at his familiar reflection in the HQ refreshers, toweling his hair, and wondering if Jason had set him up.
I didn't have to do the job. Any one of us could have passed unnoticed at a spaceport.
But it was hindsight. Jason had tasked him to do it before anyone knew where the meeting would take place. Ben still felt something was wrong, but couldn't pin it down. He just lost his buddy. Maybe that made you think crazy things. When he left the HQ building and walked out into the late afternoon sun, completely disoriented by the shifts in planetary time over the last 48 hours, he lowered his head and just walked aimlessly, hands in pockets. Suddenly, he felt someone's hand on his shoulder. He almost shrieked. He'd shut out everything around him. Then he found he was staring into his mother's face, and something was terribly wrong.
Mom! Who hit you?
Forget that, Ben. She hugged him to her, a really desperate and crushing embrace.
I've got some questions, and I will absolutely not be stalled this time.
She had hold of his shoulders, eyes scanning his face as if she was looking for injury.
This is between you and me, I swear, not your father.
They ended up in a tap calf in the Osarian quarter. Mara lowered her voice,
I want to know why you've been to Volptr. Ben was stunned. How could she possibly know?
I haven't.
You can stop the game. I know where you've been, and I have a horrible feeling I know why. The whole planet's seen the news. Mara just stared at him, not blinking. Suddenly not his mom at all. He was supposed to deny everything. He stared back, silent. Ben thought of Jory Lakoff and felt his stomach starting to knot and shake. He desperately wanted to blurt out that his buddy had died and that he wanted to roll time back to before he'd fallen into this mess and that... He couldn't get it out. She put her hand on his and squeezed.
Mom, if I tell you, will you tell me who hit you?
Okay, it was Lumaya. I caught her, but she got away. I gave her a good hiding, and she won't get away next time. Now, your turn. Ben took a deep breath. This was either going to make everything better, or be the start of something disastrous. He couldn't tell. All his force impressions had deserted him.
I did it, Mom.
Involved or did it? Ben's mouth took over without his permission.
Folding stock Carpaki, frangible round.
Mara actually sat back in her chair, and her left hand moved as if she was about to put it to her mouth. Her right hand was still clamped tight on his.
Okay,
she said.
Lakoff was killed, Mom.
Ben couldn't remember if she knew Lakoff or not. It didn't matter. He needed to say his name and tell someone.
Jory got killed. He got killed to save my skin.
Mara busied herself sipping from the cup in front of her. Why did you do it, Ben?
Orders. I was the best person to do it.
Your whole company is suddenly short of snipers? Whose orders?
Jason.
Mara was doing a reasonable job of not reacting, but Ben wasn't fooled. She was furious. Okay, sweetheart, she said. Let's not tell your dad, because he'll rip Jason's head off in the mood he's in at the moment. Can you face coming home?
I don't think so. I don't think I can sit and have dinner and not talk about this to him.
Okay, so where are you planning on going?
Home. Jason's apartment.
Ben could see she wasn't keen on the idea.
Or Captain Shivu's place.
Wherever you feel safest, Ben. I won't force you to come back with me as long as you swear you'll come to me the second you have problems. Okay?
Okay.
I'm sorry about your friend, I really am.
Nobody's ever gonna know how brave he was.
I know.
Are you angry with me?
Stupid question, you must be. How can I be, after what I used to do? She gripped both of his hands as if she was afraid he'd run away.
This is what we made you, isn't it? We wanted you to be like us. We wanted you to be a Jedi and do your duty.
Mara was quiet for a while, gazing out the window onto the sky lane packed with traffic and clearly thinking hard.
You still haven't told me how you knew, Mom.
She jerked back to the conversation, blinking.
No, I haven't. But I know, and I'm the only one who does. And I also know you can hide in the Force like Jason does. And it scares me, because the first time I felt it, I thought you'd been killed. Please, Ben, don't hide from me, ever. I wasn't, Mom. I was just trying it out.
Okay.
Am I gonna feel bad about, you know, the other guy? 'Cause right now, I don't care.
I didn't, she said, seeming to understand he meant Gedgen. Not until lately. And then it didn't feel like guilt, just not quite understanding why I did it. Because being what I was didn't explain it all to me.
I better go.
You'll be okay. I'll always be there, remember. Call me. Ben leaned forward to kiss her on the cheek. He loved her so much right then. What other mom could take news like that, horrific news, and still be there for him? He leaned farther and whispered in her ear.
He was having a secret meeting at the port with Omas to discuss a ceasefire.
When Ben straightened up, she smiled. But there was a real glint in her eye that said she was anything but happy.
Thank you,
she said.
I love you, Ben. Call me, okay? Love you too, Mom.
Republica House, Coruscant, 0100 hours, Galactic Standard Time.
Jason Solo, in the formal uniform.